This is Jim Inkster. Happy Labor Day, and welcome to Talk Louisiana. On the show today, we'll talk with former LSU football great Justin Vincent. He helped the Tigers win a national championship under Nick Lou Saban back in the year of 2003. Justin Vincent, now working for the Tiger Athletic Foundation, will comment on LSU's opening night victory in the Superdome, 27-0 over Brigham Young. The season opener for Ed Orgeron's Tigers is Saturday at home against Chattanooga. Also on the show, we'll talk with David Madden, the former LSU writer in residence, one of the best novelists to come out of Louisiana in his time or any time. 56 years he has been writing books, and he is back with a new work called Marble Goddesses and Mortal Flesh. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757, locally 297-5633, and you can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Ali Baltazar is producing, and later this hour, we'll hear from former LSU writer-in-residence David Madden, who's been writing books for 56 years. We start with Justin Vincent. He works as a development officer for the Tiger Athletic Foundation, worked in the LSU Athletic Department for 5 years, and is known as one of the Tiger greats from the 2003 National Championship team. He came to LSU a year earlier from Barb High School in Lake Charles, where he was the High School Player of the Year in our state. And in the stretch run, when Nick Saban and the Tigers won the national championship, Justin Vincent became the team's offensive leader. In the final four games, he ran for 100 or more yards, including a 201-yard performance in the SEC championship game against Georgia, and another 117 yards against Oklahoma in the BCS title game. He set the tone of the game with a 64-yard touchdown gallop in the first play for the Tigers. Justin Vincent was the most valuable player of both the 2003 SEC Championship game and the 2004 BCS Championship in the Sugar Bowl. He is with us to talk about then and now, and the Tigers opened their season, the 2017 version, 27-0 at the Superdome, defeating Brigham Young Saturday night. And good morning to you, Justin Vincent. There we go. I think we have Justin. Good morning, Justin.
Good morning.
Nice to talk with you. Now, first of all, going back to your career, what a heady start to your career. You were on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Doesn't get much better than it did your freshman year, does it?
No, that's a childhood dream. Gracing the cover of a magazine, especially something as Sports Illustrated, dream come true to win a bunch of games and have the opportunity to play for a national championship. It's a beautiful thing.
I remember that team in 2003 losing at home at Tiger Stadium 19-7 to Florida in October. And, of course, at that point there was no real idea that the team would end up winning the national championship. What happened down the stretch to make it such a magical run for you?
You know, a lot of those leaders on the team before is Marcus Spears, Michael Clayton, Marquise Hill. They kind of, took over a leadership role, and, guys kind of fell in line. And, Coach Saban and Jimbo, especially offensively, laid out a game plan and said, if we do this, we're gonna have an opportunity to win every ball game. And Joseph Addai gets hurt, and so does Chiron Carey, and I get kind of thrusted into action. And basically what everybody saw was a freshman scared to get hit running around. So it was definitely something, I will be able to remember for the rest of my life. But it was those leaders who stepped up and kind of took control of the team and said, this is what we have to do, and, kind of propelled us in the right direction.
And you are a man who has an SEC championship, a BCS title, and a Super Bowl championship. You've had quite a run in your 34 years on the planet.
Right. Yeah, it came kind of fast, just being able to be a part of something, as far as the national championship and having an opportunity to be on the team when, Steelers win the Super Bowl. Like I said before, it's like a childhood dream. You never think it's going to happen, but you dream all those long nights, and hopefully the hard work pays off. And I was very fortunate enough to have an opportunity to be a part of both.
Well, the current LSU star, Darius Geis, he had a solid game. Not spectacular, but certainly a good start. 27 carries, 122 yards Saturday as LSU thumped Brigham Young. He's about the same size you are, Justin. Some have compared his running style to yours. Is that an accurate summation?
Yeah, you know, I would actually almost compare him personally to Joseph Addai. He was kind of that motor, always kept his feet running, you know, looks for contact, but kind of avoids it at the same time. He's a very strong runner, hyper, good kid, great character. You know, the 127 yards, it was kind of quiet. I mean, there was nothing flashy about it, but, you know, they got the job done and victory.
Well, he's the real deal. He's a good one, isn't he?
Oh, most definitely. I always tell people, I go out to practice just about every other day, and he's probably the most exciting. He always seems to be upbeat, has a whole bunch of energy, which I don't know where he gets it from, other than the fact that he's young. But he's always revving and ready to go, and he gets those guys fired up, and he's going to be special.
Well, he could win the Heisman Trophy, but we're a little ways from there. But if he stays healthy, he's going to have a significant year. And I noticed that right now he's 16th all-time in LSU rushing, and the guy's number 15 is the guy we're speaking with, Justin Vincent. I have a feeling come Saturday against Chattanooga that Darius Geis may pass you, Justin.
Yeah, that's probably going to happen. I'm not going to hang my hat on that to see that stand, because obviously we want them to be successful. He needs to pass me up. You know, it's just fun to watch. You know, a few years ago I watched Leonard run by me on the sideline to break my single game record rushing. But it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to see these young guys come up and put in the hard work and seeing it pay off on Saturdays.
877-217-5757 for Justin Vincent. We're live on Labor Day for Talk Louisiana. You can send us an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. And Justin Vincent was a spectacular star as a freshman at LSU. And a listener asks how it was playing for Nick Saban. Was that a good experience?
It was. You know, I was talking to someone else the other day, and you know, listening to Nick's interviews like today, and it just kind of brings back so many memories, because his message has never changed. You know, he's always been consistent. You know, heard him say something the other day on TV about, you know, just doing your job and don't worry about the next man. And he's always said that. Always said that. So obviously he's very consistent in what he does, and obviously the results show for that.
He was exceptionally active in your recruiting, wasn't he?
He was. He actually came down to Lake Charles, Louisiana in a dang old limo with Kevin Guidry, who's a former Tiger who lives in Lake Charles. Him and my coach, Mike Haywood, came down as often as possible. I was very stern and getting me to go to LSU. And obviously, I was going to Wisconsin, but I think I made the right decision to go to LSU.
He came in a limo?
Came in a limo. They picked him up from the Lake Charles Airport in a limo and pulled up to my mom's house. And I can remember my mom's reaction. He's like, I cannot believe this man is showing up to my house in a limo.
What did the neighbors think?
Oh, man, everybody came outside. They had no idea who it was at the time. And then to see him getting out, and Kevin Guidry was back there with them. You know, everybody could do anything but laugh. It's pretty funny now that we look back at it.
Well, this was before he had won his first national championship. You won his first national championship. He's got five of them now. But did you know then that this man who is approaching 50 years old and had been bumped around a bit in his career, that he was going to be as special as he has become?
No, I mean, obviously you never kind of can see into the future, but like I said, his message has always been stern. He's always been consistent. You know, like I said, he's saying the same things he said 14 years ago today. So I think he had a plan. He just needed to get himself around some great coaches and some good players and put his plan into action. And he was able to do that consistently now for the last few years.
Do you recall what he was dressed like when he showed up at your house?
He was in a suit. He's always suit. And you know, we used to always give him a hard time, especially once I got on campus. He never liked wearing socks. He had those little nice Italian loafers and hated wearing socks.
So he was in a suit with no socks.
No socks. That's how he rolled.
Did your mom feed him?
I don't remember if we ate or not. I don't think we had time for dinner. I think I had just came back from a baseball game when he showed up. But he spent about an hour or so with me. We watched some barb football on a little VHS tape, and you know, sat down, and they ended up getting out of there.
Well, you played for him for a couple of years, and then a couple for Les Miles. But when he left, what did that do to the program?
It was kind of devastating at first because he told everybody he wasn't going to leave, and then they come to find out once we get to the bowl game, he tells us that he's leaving us. It was kind of a gut-wrenching thing. I figured at the end of the day, you know, some of our leaders, they were going around saying that we're going to be okay, which is always true. Coaches move on all the time. But, you know, he was special to the pointing LSU in the right direction before he left. And, you know, and Coach Miles stepped in and carried the torch for as long as he could. But I think Nick, it was kind of heartbreaking to the ones who just got there, especially, you know, I was a second-year guy that he was leaving. But
certainly a contrast between Saban and Miles.
100%. Personality-wise, you know, it may be hard for people to kind of wrap their mind around it, but when it came time for football, you know, Coach Miles and Coach Saban, they're the same people. They love to stick to their script, but when it came personalities, they're two different people.
877-217-5757 is your number. Locally, 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. Email talk@talklouisiana.org. We're hearing the voice of Justin Vincent, former LSU great, now development officer for the Tiger Athletic Foundation. And we're back after this short timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is producing in another segment with Justin Vincent, former LSU Tiger great. He was the most valuable player for the SEC championship game against Georgia and the BCS title game against Oklahoma. January of 2004, LSU won its first championship in 45 years as the Tigers beat the Sooners 21-14 with Nick Saban at the helm. Saban would leave the program less than 2 years later, and Les Miles took over and had a good 12-year run, and now we're with Ed Orgeron. In his first season opener, the Tigers prevailed 27-0 Saturday at the Superdome against Brigham Young, a game that was scheduled to be played in Houston. And Justin Vincent, your position with the Tiger Athletic Foundation probably meant you were on the front lines when all this commotion was going on a week ago when LSU was deciding where it was going to play its game. Actually, ESPN was deciding. What was that like with the uncertainty a week ago at this time?
Oh, it's pretty hectic, you know, just to have an opportunity to play the first game and not have to make it up or postpone it. I think that was the biggest issue for ESPN and both of the schools, just to make sure they got it done in a safe manner and, you know, everybody was okay. And but yeah, it was kind of tough because a lot of those coaches and fans and everybody wanted to get it done. But obviously safety is the first priority for both schools. And I'm just glad that, you know, New Orleans ended up being a venue for us to take advantage of.
Were you pleased with the crowd?
I was. It was actually a whole lot more than I expected. 53,000 folks showed up for a replacement game, and that's always a positive.
Yeah, 53,000 was impressive. And this week, it's the home opener against an extremely weak opponent. People generally show up for home openers, but the danger is that the stadium will be more than half empty by halftime. How is it getting ready for a weak link like Chattanooga, a team that lost its opening game by 2 touchdowns to mighty Jacksonville State? Is it going to be a tough sell, or will people come in droves as they often do?
I think people will come in droves. You know, obviously, like you said, it's the first game of the year, but at the same time, you don't want to take these teams lightly. Everybody always wants to see a team like a Chattanooga or whoever that else may be. But you know, these guys are looking forward to the opportunity to play in front of the LSU crowd, and hopefully, people will show up in droves and come out to support them. And you know, if the game gets out of hand, I totally agree. You know, you try to get out of there because the whole traffic is situation, but I think it'll be a great turnout to be, say, the first game of the year.
Listener asked about Alabama's game against Florida State. The Crimson Tide looked rather impressive Saturday.
Yeah, they actually look pretty dang on good. I didn't get a chance to watch the whole game. I saw maybe like the first quarter, and the rest was highlights for me. But obviously, Alabama's Alabama. They're not gonna deter from their message and the way they approach the game. And they got some really, really good players, and they're coached really, really well. You know, they knocking the quarterback out of the game. That's going to put a crinkle in Jimbo's plans, but. That's the way they play defense, fast and aggressive, and they attacked, and they got a victory.
When you say Jimbo, he was your offensive coordinator. You know the Florida State coach well as well.
Definitely. Jimbo's a good friend of mine as I became older. He's always been a mentor, always someone who said, give him a call if I needed anything. He and his son, Trey, who I've been fortunate enough to know him since he was a baby, have always been good to me.
Well, this week should be a victorious one. It would really be unusual if it were not, but yesterday, look what happened to Texas A&M. They were ahead by 34 points over UCLA and lost the game 45-44. That was an amazing turnaround, wasn't it?
Definitely. I would think that in my lifetime, I would have never seen a comeback greater than the Falcons and the New England Patriots this past year. But that was what I think it was around 44-7 or 41-10 or something like that.
Yeah. And lost.
And they came back and scored
5 touchdowns in a row.
Yeah, that was amazing. The resilience. That quarterback was hurt last year, and he came back and laid it all on the line and performed extremely well for his ball club. And they walked away with a victory. And actually, what I was listening to before the game, they called it the hot seat game. Both of those coaches on the hot seat. They got to win. They got to perform. If they don't, the man's going to be on the street looking for another job. So I don't know. And then I seen a message today this morning on the news that one of the Board of Regents guys for Texas A&M is speaking very loudly about Coach Sumlin and wanting to get him out of there.
Isn't that something? A point can make all the difference in the world. But look what happened to Les Miles last year. If LSU wins that game at Auburn, he might still be the coach.
Possibly still be our guy right now. But, yeah, that's the nature of the beast, man. A lot of people, I've had an opportunity to be on both sides of the aisle now when it comes to coaching and administration and being a player. You got to win. At the end of the day, you got to win. That's all that matters. It doesn't matter who the opponent is. You got to get a victory because, once people get a taste of the good life, the winning, there's no turning back. You got to win some ball games to keep people happy.
What makes a good coach?
Someone who understands the players. I hate to use the term players coach. It's very overused. But I think someone who understands the players and gets their players ready to go at any given time, but is always willing to give your players time to have time off and just keep the morale up. Because you can practice is practice, and the games are, it is what it is. But as long as you can keep that good balance between having fun, being stern, and being that father figure that they can look up to, that you'll have all the success in the world because at the end of the day, they'll play for you. And that's all you want out of the player.
Yeah. Justin, I've talked to many LSU players through the years after their careers at Tiger Town have ended, and to a man, they all say when the team runs out on the field, as LSU will Saturday under those goalposts, they want to get back in uniform and get on the field. Do you get goosebumps to this day?
I get goosebumps, but I had my fun in the sun. I don't want to go back out there. I've had every opportunity to for my career, and I just love, I get the itch by watching those young kids get out there and running around. I don't ever want to strap it up. My adrenaline starts pumping up a little bit, but I don't want to put them on anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the decade since you've left, a little over a decade, the size of the players is enormous. The offensive linemen in particular, these guys are pushing 400 pounds now.
400 pounds and running 5.3 40s and the whole nine. Yeah, we got some pretty amazing set of kids these days, day and age. Everybody's bigger, stronger, faster. That's why you see all these injuries now. I think a lot of kids in they need to come up with some better rules as far as the hitting of the helmets and the targeting and all that, because if the kids are bigger and faster, the hits are going to be more brutal. So I think taking care of the players and doing everything you can to protect their livelihood once they're done playing ball is a good thing, because, like you said, they're a different breed of kids these days.
When you were playing, how much time did you spend in the weight room?
Oh, Coach Moffitt had us in there 3 days a week. You know, legs one day, uppers the next, and then we do like some auxiliary lifts on like a Thursday or Friday before a game, so you wouldn't kind of wear yourself out just to get the blood flowing. You stay in there 24/7. You're always running and doing some type of conditioning, but as far as lifting weights, you only did it about 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm. You've kept it up, haven't you?
I kept it up. I have. You know, I have a little boy now, and you know, I try to stay as firm as I can for that guy, because he always has me running around like crazy.
And you weighed, what, about close to 220 when you played, didn't you?
Yeah, I was between 215 and 220.
Yeah, you're about there now? Is that about right?
Yeah, I'm actually about 228 right now. I'm a little bit heavier, but I feel a whole lot better than what I did back then.
And I bet you can still bench press your weight.
I can. That is something I do always stay in the weight room and try to stay firm.
Well, go get him. Thank you, Justin Vincent, now development officer for the Tiger Athletic Foundation. It's been a pleasure, and hope you have a good season.
You do. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And we'll be back after this news break with Karen Henderson with the remarkable David Madden, 56 years as a novelist, former LSU writer in residence, after this time out on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us on Labor Day for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing, and we're joined now by David Madden. For many years, he was the LSU writer in residence. He now lives in North Carolina, and he is still publishing after all these years. It started in 1961 for David Madden with The Beautiful Greed, and it continues 56 years later with Marble Goddesses and Mortal Flesh. Good morning, David Madden.
Good morning, Jim.
Nice to talk with you. And you actually began as a radio announcer, didn't you? And you were going back to your media genesis.
Oh, yeah. When I was 15, I was actually in Knoxville, Tennessee on one of the major stations, mainly at night, the Night Watchman show, you know, a disc jockey, and announcing the news. It came about because we were able at Knoxville High School to have our own program, a short program, and I wrote, directed, and acted in some dramas I created. And then they said, well, why don't you come on and be a disc jockey at night? It went very well until this was for country music, until I said that Ivy Lee Hill would request the Romeo and Juliet Overture by Tchaikovsky. And the owner called up and said, David, I know that was you putting somebody up to it, your girlfriend. You're fired.
So that was
But then I was in Boone, North Carolina, too. I was on a radio there announcing, so, yeah.
All right.
And then one of my novels is called On the Big Wind, which is our term for being on the air, and that's all about one announcer who just went through all kinds of avatars, all kinds of persona, about 10 different ones until he became a CBS narrator. So, yeah, very much.
And you went to San Francisco State University. I think one of your classmates was a fellow named Ernest Gaines.
Yeah, I wish we had really known each other. We probably talked briefly without either of us knowing who we would become, but wanting to become who we became, and now we're good friends. We have been since I moved to Louisiana and connected up with him and invited him to my class. I think he's one of the finest writers of our time, and there's one short story, Just Like a Tree, that I think is a masterpiece.
He's had several, as have you. But you, Ernest, and my dear friend Gus Weil were all born in the year of 1933. That was quite a quite a year for Louisiana, even though Jerry David Madden was born in Knoxville, Tennessee. How did you end up in Louisiana?
Let's see. I think, my old teacher at the University of Tennessee, I encountered him at one of those conventions, and he said, why don't you come down and create the creative writing program at LSU. I think we need it. I think it would be a good thing. There's only one or two courses being offered by the same person. So I thought, I was really crazy about All the King's Men and also liked the moviegoer. So I thought I would like to live in the town where Robert Penwarren taught and where he got the material for All the King's Men, and also go down to New Orleans, the setting of The Moviegoer by Walker Percy. So both of them became good friends, and I published a book about Robert Penwarren called The Legacy of Robert Penwarren. So, and I put him on the map when I was head of the creative writing program by having a couple of conferences which produced that book I was referring to, and programs when nobody was doing anything, when LSU was continuing to neglect him. You know, he was very saddened by the fact that they didn't increase his salary when he had an offer somewhere else. So that was a great experience, really.
Yeah. Well, you lived on Park Boulevard in Baton Rouge for many years, and I would imagine a lot of luminaries came in and out of the home of David and Roberta Madden through those years.
James Lee Burke, with his wife or girlfriend, is so far back, it could have been either one. She was blonde. Maybe his wife is blonde. Knocked at my door. I didn't know who he was. And I was writing Bijou, one of my favorite books, and didn't want to be disturbed. And he said, but I'd like to meet the guy that wrote Cassandra singing, because I learned how to write well by reading that book. And I said, well, okay, come on in. And brought him into my study, and he walked straight in a room, as you remember, I think you've been over there, totally full of books. He walked straight to a paperback called New Campus Writing, pulled it off, and I said, well, that's not Cassandra singing. And he opened it right to the page, and I said, but that's a one-act play version. I hadn't even written the novel. And he read with great feeling, Lone laid the cap, crown down on the cot. And he said, the sound, the rhythm, the alliteration, I mean, everything's right there as far as style goes. So that was a marvelous experience. He'd published only one or two books, wasn't well known at the time. Then pretty soon, he became very famous.
James Lee Burke, who, of course, has had a magnificent career. Now, Cassandra Singing, the one that he loved so much, that was a book that you wrote in 1954, I believe, but it wasn't published until 15 years later. What happened?
Well, for one thing, I was a perfectionist. As Flaubert said, the mot juste, the word, the just perfect word, I was... And I still am. A lot of my works extended over from 6 to 10. That was, Bijou was 6. Cassandra Singing was 15. But I was writing the play version, the movie script version. No, wait a minute, that came after the book was published. Play version, short story version, radio play version. And it was done quite often as a one-act or a full-length. Over that period of time, but then teaching, and then also just writing other things, including other books. The first novel, The Beautiful Greed, was actually written simultaneously with Cassandra Singing, and I didn't regard it as too important, but Walter Van Tilburg Clark, who's the author of The Oxbow Incident, a classic movie, but he was the author of the novel. It was my teacher at San Francisco State, and he said, David, you're not going to be able to finish Cassandra Singing for your dissertation, so why don't you just expand that other work of yours based on your days as a seaman, which I did, and it was accepted. And then, you know, it was accepted as the first novel. And by the way, Marble Goddesses and Mortal Flesh leads off with the short version that he read and asked me to expand. So that's interesting.
The Beautiful Greed, 1961, your first published work, and now your latest in 2017, Marble Goddesses and Mortal Flesh. 56 years,
yeah.
Two-thirds of your life. How has this happened that you've stayed the course so long?
Well, gosh, I don't know, but, you know, compared with other writers I know, writers I admire and written books about or significant articles, they've been generally rather unhappy or alcoholic, which is not necessarily the same thing as unhappy, or depressed, like William Styron. But I haven't been that way. When I was, from the beginning, I've been very happy with Robbie and my wife, who you know very well, and with my son, with my life generally. And so when I write, I don't write to escape. I don't write to express myself, even with autobiographical stuff, which, by the way, Marble Goddesses and Mortal Flesh, four novellas, are all about Lucius Hutchfield, and that's based, all four of them are based on my experiences, except for the last one, in which I project myself, or the character, into the future, and he becomes obsessed by the movies and buys the old movie theater. But that's building on Bijou, which is probably most successful of my books. And so, you know, I compared with James Agee, for instance. He wrote out of, which I've, about whom I've written a book and four or five major articles, and from my hometown. He, along with Cormac McCarthy, by the way, he was very depressed most of the time, and cynical. In fact, a piece written about me compared the two of us and said, well, David Madden is more positive in the way he sees life than James Agee. Of course, Agee's wonderful. I love him. But I hadn't thought of it that way. One of my students came to me one time and said, why are you always writing about death? I had no idea I was writing about death. I was just writing words, you know.
Well, you've had this wonderful relationship with Roberta, and I think you've said the line before, but she credits your marital success to the fact that you're in love with the same man, right?
Yeah, I confess I've had a lifelong love affair with myself. And maybe that explains why I continue to write. You know, I'm involved. Are we back?
We're going to take a break here in a moment, okay. But you're involved in what?
I'm involved in two books at once, which are very near completion.
All right, we're going to take a short break. 877-217-5757 is your number. David Madden is the guest. The celebrated novelist who spent many years as LSU's writer-in-residence, and we're back after this two-minute pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster with David Madden and producer Ali Baltazar, and your number is 877-217-5757. David Madden, who started his brilliant career as a novelist in 1961 with The Beautiful Greed, is continuing to this day with Marble Goddesses and Mortal Flesh, four novellas published in 2017. Earlier you said you thought Bijou was your most successful work, set in a movie theater in Knoxville. I understand that you were an usher at this same theater, weren't you, David?
Oh, yeah, when I was about 13 or 14, and I was really crazy about the movies. So Alan Ladd was my hero, but I was really haunted by that place. And when we lived in Gambier, Ohio, and I was editor of Kenyon Review, one of the editors, one night I started talking to Robbie nostalgically about the Bijou and started describing every little detail. And before I knew it, it was about 3 o'clock in the morning. She knew it because she was really upset to be kept awake that long. By the way, when we talk about the writers, Louisiana writers that I've known, let's don't leave out Tennessee Williams, who was a sort of friend of mine. We've talked and met several times. And when he died, about a week before he died, I asked him if I could write a play about him and Carson McCullers. And he says, only if I can write it with you. So we were about to write a play together.
Oh, my.
When he strangled on that bottle cap, I think it was, a medicine bottle cap. And I want to say about the positive attitude, you know I'm very, very resentful of what happened to the U.S. Civil War Center at LSU. But the whole time that I was there, when people were criticizing my colleagues were criticizing Baton Rouge is this little old town, and LSU is not quite up to the standards, their own standards. I almost never engaged in that. In fact, my affection is such that when I couldn't sleep last night because I was going over too many interesting things, I went up and down every single street in Baton Rouge in my mind, and it was a wonderful experience. I wasn't sleepless and, you know, how you toss and turn. I was like, oh, yeah, and then this and then that. And, you know, Park Boulevard, of course, is iconic in my life. But
how many years were you there?
41. Robbie probably correct me. I'm always getting stuff like that wrong. I'm always going around saying I'm 85. She said, you're not 85, you're 84.
Yeah, well. 41 years, that beautiful home, I think, what is 714 Park?
614.
614. I'm one number off, too.
But
I'm one number off as well. Now, why did you leave after all those years in that home that was part of the fabric of our city? Why did you leave?
You know, we talked about it with my son of coming to Black Mountain because my son lives here and our granddaughter, but we would always bring up the fact on Robbie's part mainly that she was so intricately involved with so many people and so many causes, well, two or three major causes, that she didn't think she could leave. And I was ready to leave any time because I came there with a 10-year commitment to live as deep in the South as I could, and then I would leave. And but I stayed really because of Robbie's political involvement. And then one day I said, you know, Blake really wants us to come down there. And she says, okay. So it was just, you know, one of those things totally out of the blue that she was ready to go. And, of course, you know, within about a week she took this little town by storm, and then she colonized Asheville on race relations and the Equal Rights Amendment, and she's in there right now at her desk in our house, which is also a smaller house, but a house that people really love to come to. We have big Christmas parties, as we did there, and people walk in, and they say, oh, this is such a wonderful house. It's the atmosphere. In fact, you know, people, when they walked into the Civil War Center, said the same thing. There's something about this place. It's because they could feel the positive vibes and the imaginative energy, because my whole approach was very imaginative.
Well, and that said, you certainly were no fan of the Confederacy.
No, not really. I was open to studying the history. I was interested in Robert E. Lee. I was interested in Stonewall Jackson, mainly in the worst of them, Nathan Bedford Forrest, but simultaneously I really liked Grant, and almost nobody likes Grant that much. I think his autobiography is a masterpiece. I can't name any other Union generals I care that much about. But, you know, you and I had a conversation on air recently about the monuments. I really liked what you said about, what about all those monuments and names of streets, including where the Civil War Center used to be on the LSU campus? What about them? Tear all those down? And it came to me spontaneously, no, I think everybody concerned ought to sit down and discuss it. And I noticed that David Blight, the famous Civil War historian who I'm bringing here in a week or so to speak, that's what he said in an interview he had about the monuments. He said, we need to sit down and discuss this, and each community discuss it and come up with alternatives, or, you know, decide to tear them all down or leave them up or move them to museums. So I think that's a very, very healthy trend that we're going to be seeing. The people themselves who put it up talking about what they're going to do.
All right. A few inquiries from listeners. This is Tracy asking if Donald Trump were a fictional character, would anyone believe him?
I used to think that about Nixon. When writers that I knew, novelists, wrote novels about Nixon, I thought, well, he's a boring character. But you can't say that about Trump. He's not boring. He's monstrously fascinating. But yeah, it would have to be Jonathan Swift. You know, like Gulliver's Travels, a satirical work, a massive satirical work, I think, to get our attention, to be interesting, because, you know, there's just nowhere to go with him. He is so totally self-expressive that no kind of writer, satirical or otherwise, would have much more to say, don't you think?
Well, it's an amazing world we're in, and it's in large part because of our president. Now, another listener asks about a writer born 10 years before you. I think you knew him, and that's the question. How well did you know Norman Mailer?
Norman Mailer, yeah, he was one of my favorites. I haven't read very much of him. I haven't even read Naked and the Dead. I read Why Are We in Vietnam and some of the essays. But I met him, and he began to fascinate me, and we corresponded. And one time I said to him, you know, I think that you could write the great Civil War novel from a Jewish perspective, a Northerner's perspective, a veteran's perspective, famous for Naked in the Dead about World War II. And he said, no, David, I think that you're the one to do it. And he told Sarah Sue Goldsmith that, and she published that comment where I asked him, and he gave his answer. But I think we don't have writers like that anymore. We don't have celebrity writers anymore. And when I was about 20 or 30 years ago, and I was seeing Norman Mailer in the news and William Steyer, and I was thinking, oh, who are they? We don't have writers like Thomas Wolfe or Ernest Hemingway anymore. But today, I mean, of course, Cormac McCarthy has a certain celebrity about him, but I'm talking about serious writers. Who do we have that everybody would recognize visually, you know, and like Tennessee Williams?
Right.
I mean,
yeah,
nobody... In the theater, there, name one playwright whose face you can see or whose works you can quote who's still around. Now, Tom Stoppard and a few, Shepard just died. I met him, by the way, one time when one of his first plays, and he was being extremely mean-spirited and obnoxious to a priest who was walking out on one of his plays, which I later reviewed. But then I grew to really like him as a person, as an actor. You know, I would never say anything.
You have quite a fan club as well, David Madden, and you're back in a big way with Marble Goddesses and Mortal Flesh, four novellas from David Madden. Congratulations on your latest work, David, and let's keep it going. I look forward to our next conversation.
Well, thanks a lot, Jim. I look forward to talking to you again, too. Bye.
And thanks for listening. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.